Jason Horsley and The Liminalist, the podcast between. This is part two of my conversation with Heather Poirier of Notes on H.P. Lovecraft.blogspot.com. Heather and I are discussing the second season of Nick Pizzolatto's True Detective.
It's the idea that there's a thing that can go from person to person, this idea that can go in and destroy people's lives. And, you know, the interesting thing about season two is, that's a lot of maybe saying, it's this idea of the American dream that is, in fact, a weaponized meme.
Right.
I mean, this is what happens when people try to, people, you know, who don't have the right kind of access, try to fulfill the American dream for themselves. That in some way, parts of them have to be destroyed, whether it's, you know, their dreams of youth, you know, of, you know, being rich and famous or whatever, the dreams of having children, the dreams of being a multi-generationally wealthy family, whatever. These ideas destroy people. And here, in this particular situation, here are the ideas and here's who's dying.
So do you think that, well, this is fascinating area, and do you think that a show like True Detective that is attempting to demonstrate how these weaponized memes work and how they infiltrate people, I would say they're not entirely or solely destructive, but they're also like a way to colonize people and turn them into agents of the dominant culture as well, which of course does destroy their lives in the long, but in a very slow, incremental fashion.
Yeah, absolutely, I would agree. And that's how it works in Snow Crash, you recall, because you just read it. You know, it's this it's this religious idea that that sort of goes into people's minds and psyches and changes things radically.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of the function of the American dream and other ideals. And it's not just in America. I mean, there's cultural ideals all over the place that do this to people.
Well, ideology in general, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard interesting stories about the Aborigines in Australia, who, you know, because they've got this idea, they believe that they can't, only certain people can go on this little patch of land here. People who have access to that patch of land could go in and murder people and get away with it because there won't be any witnesses and nobody can go in and follow them. And because it's Aboriginal land, the Australian police can't do anything. I mean, it's just an idea. It is only an idea that is holding people back.
Yeah.
But those ideas govern behavior in ways that are extreme.
Yeah.
And subtle. But yeah, in all different kinds of ways, especially extreme and subtle, like you're saying.
Yeah. So to go back to my unfinished question, do you think that it's possible that a work of art, and I'm very hesitant to use that word at all, but anyway, what we think of as a work of art, something that really moves us deeply and connects to us in some deep way that resonates for us, like for me this True Detective, do you think it's aspiring to and even maybe capable of inoculating us from those weaponized memes?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really specific what it can inoculate you from, kind of like vaccines in general are really specific. But yeah, I think it can. I think if, of course, people can be exposed to an inoculating meme and be unwilling to accept its message.
Yeah.
And therefore it doesn't work. But yeah, if you're willing to hear what it says and accept it, which is really just critical thinking, if you think about it, if you're willing to do that, then, yeah, I think it totally can.
Well, certainly that would, I mean, that was my sense with The Counselor, that it did carry this kind of inoculation against the meme of the American dream and, you know, all kinds of connecting ideologies, and that related to why it was so reviled and despised generally by critics and by the public. And so then I thought, oh, maybe the same thing is happening with True Detective season 2, and that it's at a very surface level, it's a bummer, it's a downer, it is dispelling illusions, and nobody likes that. But we're talking about a much deeper level. It's like if you let that in, it's like a positive virus. Well, positive depending on your point of view, but like a virus that will just eat away at these ideologies until there's nothing left. And who wants that? Certainly not from their entertainment. It's not really an entertaining process. I mean, I was entertained by True Detective, but by the end of it, I did feel, like I said in the piece, like I'd been suffered some internal hemorrhaging or something. Like I did feel really torn up by it, and I, and of course, that wasn't that the show did that to me, but somehow it by watching it, I connected to some internal wounding that I've managed to numb myself to. And became aware of it, and so that, yeah, that wasn't, that's not entertainment. That would seem to be what, this idea of art, if it has some real function besides another cultural commodity, and this is back to the Greeks again, and the archetypal narratives, that it is some sort, and that's why I actually use the word science in my piece for it. There seems to be some actual methodology to using images and ideas. I mean, if they can be used to colonize us and corrupt us, then presumably they can also be used to heal and transform.
Yeah, I think so. And you were talking about advertising earlier. I think that, once you start understanding the tropes of advertising, the significance is drastically reduced. Their impact on you is drastically reduced. I think that, but again, it's the part of that makes it really difficult cultural work to perform. Is that there are so many instances of weaponized memes that you have to come in and inoculate against. And, if you're lucky, you'll get one that'll cover a few of them. But I think it's coming in from so many sides that the work is just really difficult. And I think that's why, people start and stop, and it has to be redone. It has to be retransmitted. And what gets transmitted are the weaponized memes. The inoculating memes don't get transmitted. Or as you were saying in the UK, 10 years ago, the stuff that you guys were saying 10 years ago is now on the front pages of the papers. And so it's taken 10 years just for this to come to the surface. It's going to have to continue to be done because human nature doesn't really ever change.
Right, and it seems as though once it's come to the surface, it's actually become useful as a weaponized meme by that point. That's my feeling, that the revelations in the UK might seem like something's changing, but actually they're more the way to ensure that nothing changes.
Because and part of it is, and it kind of this is what happened in season one, and perhaps to an extent in season two, they're able to localize the trouble onto one figure, or they're in season two onto this small group of figures. And here's where the problem was. We weren't the problem. These guys were the problem. Here's where your murderers were. They're both dead now, or she's on a bus and he's dead. This is. Yeah, this it, it everything is opposite. Families are torn apart, relationships are broken, This is what happens when you're the bearer of the inoculating meme. The price that you pay for bringing that information, you're the Cassandra. The price you pay for bringing that information, either people won't believe you or you'll get murdered. Welcome, congratulations. This is the reward for all the work that you're doing. So it's no wonder that people choose the weaponized memes, because there's a promise. Even if it's a lie, there is a promise of a reward at the end. I mean, you really are kind of, Pavlovian, with dogs and bells and rats and maces and things like that.
Well, as I put in my piece, I was kind of glad that True Detective, the second season, was getting such flack, and I was glad for various reasons. And one of them occurs to me while we're talking was for Nick Pizzolatto. And I mean, because if he's doing this, however consciously, like trying to deliver an inoculating meme using, corporate culture, which is all about delivering the weaponized memes, to try and Trojan horse his way into the collective psyche that way, he shouldn't be rewarded for it, because then that would mean that he wasn't being effective.
It's complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, these things, it's, you have to use algebra and not arithmetic. And maybe that was part of the detective's problem in the second season, is they were trying to solve an algebraic problem with using arithmetic. But they had, I think they had the right motivations. They were all willing to sacrifice themselves to do, to ultimately to do what was right and to get the information out.
Are you talking about season one now or season two?
Season two.
Well, because Frank wasn't
Season
willing to sacrifice
yeah,
himself.
season one's got a different, Frank is going to try to get out, but I mean, he's going to try to get out. He's always been able to get out before. So, yeah.
So these would all be a aspects of Pizzolatto. If we can bring it
Yeah.
back to the this overarching idea of the artist investigator, which I love. I mean, I don't know because you haven't written enough about it for me to read to know where you're going with that. But one of the things
I've
that
written a ton. I just haven't put it on the blog. It's in my notebooks.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll definitely look forward to that. But one of the things that I checked yesterday while I was writing that piece, and as I say, it affected me so deeply, emotional level, and maybe even deeper than emotionally, that I mean, all this stuff started coming up, and I knew it was about masculinity and wounded masculinity, and that's a no-brainer. But then I noticed all these the father themes and just how dominant they are throughout. So one of the first things I looked into was whether Pizzolatto was a father, and it turns out he is. He has a daughter a few years ago, because I wanted to know, well, A, was I on the right track, and B, was if so, was what he's doing with this work, is it self-exploratory? Is he wrestling with and working through things that have been stirred up in himself that he needs to find some sort of resolution for, which to me is the what makes the difference between a genuinely transformative work of self-expression and just another corporate product which is going to spread these memes that we're talking about, is does it have the transmission of this individual soul who's the artist investigator trying to crack his own case, so to speak?
Yeah, it's and it's interesting how Pizzolatto, in the second season, I think you're right. I think Pizzolatto is himself the artist investigator, because there's no artists in this season, precious few investigators. But I think it's definitely, I don't want to say it's autobiography, because I think that gives it short shrift, really. I think it's way more complex than
Yeah.
that. But yeah, I think. As much as anything, too, I think it's, in addition to Pizzolatto looking at these issues of fatherhood and progeny and history moving forward, those kinds of things. What are you bringing with you? What are you passing on? What do what fatal flaws in yourself are you trying to avoid passing on to your kids? I mean, the whole idea of a fatal flaw is another weaponized meme. But in addition to that, I think he is also talking about the difficulty and the struggle in writing itself. Because the school of deconstruction says that ultimately all writing is about the act of writing.
Is
And
about
I don't know
what,
if I
sorry?
all writing is about the act of writing. Whatever is written, whatever, things that are published
That's so
are
great,
ultimately.
because that's what I ended up writing in the book I published this year, Seen and Not Seen, which is also about trying to crack my own cases. And this is what liminalism is about in a nutshell. It's about writing about the act of writing this very sentence, like bringing it all the way to that sort of infinite regression point.
Right. And deconstruction, I don't know if you've read much about that, but the school of literary criticism that talks about that most is deconstruction. And so second season is very much about looking at it from that point of view, also very much about the difficulty in constructing a solid detective story and having convincing characters, correctly motivated characters, good bad guys, bad bad guys, fatal flaws, because you got to have fatal flaws in both investigators and it has to do with the evolution of detective fiction, but you have fatal flaws in both investigators and criminals now. All of this stuff, how difficult is it to construct this story? And can you effectively construct a story with these elements that you're sort of forced to reckon with at this point? And yeah, I think a lot of season two is about that. Like with the sex scene. Sex scenes typically, well, not after the 20th century, but for a long time, sex scenes, when they were around, went a certain way, often off stage. And then in television, at least, they went a certain way. But now they're way more complex. And in this particular season, you know, the sex scenes were extremely difficult ones. So, you know, the difficulty of writing, what is now an effective sex scene? What does the audience expect? How are the characters supposed to interact given what they are? You can't have the traditional romantic stuff anymore. It's just not going to work because nobody's going to believe it because people know that doesn't exist anymore. Mm. That genre is extremely narrow right now. And back to the whole social engineering thing, a lot of that has to do with market share. If the Harlequin romances were huge right now, that sex scene probably would have been a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not because sex is super complicated. So, yeah, I mean, if going back and rewatching season two with this idea that it is about the act of writing, the act of constructing a detective story, it's super interesting to look at.
Hmm. So do you think part of that, then, the exploration or investigation for Pizzolatto would be the context of the second season, like just comparing it to band's second album? There's a lot more pressure. His whole life has changed because he's become this superstar hotshot HBO writer in the interim, though. So presumably his whole social circumstances would have changed, and his interiority would have been maybe even threatened by that, because this is the same culture that he's trying to examine and even expose to some extent.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very much a story about the entry into a different world. So again, in some sense, you know, with these transformations, he's got access to an underworld he never saw before. And, you know, is he trying to talk about that? Possibly so. You know, it would make sense that he's at this point, you know, with the second season, I think it's probably inevitable that his personal circumstances, especially like you're saying, those changes in those circumstances are going to be reflected in this. He's talking about California. He's talking about a place that doesn't actually exist, Vinci, which means when. Which, if you think about the entertainment industry, this is sort of, and it's a place that puts out a ton of industrial pollution, which a lot of people, you know, characterize Hollywood's output as industrial pollution. It has relatively few people in it. It has mostly undocumented workers who work for basically nothing and do all the scrap work. I mean, it is such a metaphor for Hollywood that it is just kind of mind blowing. And it's very well concealed, I think. It is not obvious. And I think it's because he gives it that industrial setting that it doesn't initially seem like it's going to be that way. But after a point, you see, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, this really is sort of this larger metaphor for the entertainment industry.
Wow.
And what's...
Yeah, no, I hadn't seen that at all. That's great.
Your soul is able, death is cannot fight it. All the world denies it. Open up your eyelids and let your demons run.
So what about the transportation thing? Because that was pretty much the only thing he gave away before the season, was that it was about the secret occult, which is a bit of overemphasis there, the secret occult history of the transportation system in the U.S.
Yeah, so. Well, I think he was sort of tweaking people's noses a bit, because occult simply just means hidden. So one of the things, and I should sort of say as full disclosure, my husband is an attorney with the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Oh.
And I do not pry him for information, because he has a super high security clearance and he couldn't even tell me if he wanted to. But what I do know is there's a very, and you can get this outside of having being married to a guy like this, but there's a very long history of corruption in various sub-industries of our transportation system. Just like Frank Simeon says in the first episode, there are guaranteed overages. The feds have this budget. There are guaranteed overages. People are going to be drawn to that. People of all kinds are going to be drawn to that. Teamsters, you know, long history of corruption in the trucking industry. There's local and national legendary stories about corruption in the highway building industry. I mean, it's just all over the place. So the fact that this is about a rail line, yeah, I was like, oh yeah, it is totally going to be about something like this, because this is an entire set of motivations and actions, and it's the internal, one of the branches of the internal armature of this story that is going to be just rock solid. I mean, there's a ton of stuff you can pull from that. You ultimately find out it's about double crossing and border disputes and salting the land with heavy metals and to make it, you know, cheaper so that people can buy parcels and pave over it. Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, that is completely plausible. Totally plausible.
But it's not really central, and it's not really over in terms of, most viewers are not going to think that this show is about transportation, or besides aerial shots of cars on highways, there isn't really any emphasis on that theme.
Cars on the Pacific Coastal Highway specifically. I mean, they always seem to be driving up and down this one little section. Looks like it's near Big Sur. I could be wrong about that. But always driving up and down this one very pretty little area. Or over L.A., which is where all of those big, the big multi-lane interstate interchanges. A lot of local footage. But yeah, and I think they've probably dealt with the whole question about the importance of the transportation industry pretty early on, when they emphasized the local nature of what was going on. It's really a state level thing. Even though the feds are named, you don't ever see anybody representing that group. That person never ever shows up. And I think that's the best way to handle that, is just not bring that in, because now you're talking about massive complexity.
Mm.
It's already a complex enough plot. It's already difficult enough to track who is trying to double-cross who and who is trying to avoid double-crossing who. So you don't need that. So I think they did that right.
So what would you say the larger metaphor then is for the transportation system?
Well, it's, I would put it as essentially the equivalent, or like the circulation system for the money, because that's really what it's providing.
Right.
Like I said before, money doesn't really exist unless it's moving. If you bury money in your backyard, it might as well not exist. So it, unless it's in motion, it doesn't actually do anything. And this rail corridor will connect people, but more importantly, it will connect these parcels that represent ongoing, long-term sources of income for people. And that's, so it's sort of a sub-circulatory system for this very small group of investors.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me think of blood, though, when you talk about a circulatory system and that it doesn't exist unless if it's move, unless it's moving, like the body dies if the blood stops moving.
Right, right.
And then, of course, the Da Vinci thing, as you said, it means I conquer what's been conquered on one level, very broad level, is nature. It's this industrialized place that's polluting the planet. So then the circulatory system of the transport system is kind of replacing or damaging or influencing anyway the natural circulatory system of the biosphere. Not that I'm saying it has a greenest message, but again the metaphor there in terms of like these characters who have lost their wholeness, have lost their connection to their bodies, who've been fragmented psychically, and so they've become like these carriers of the memes that we're talking about. They've become weaponized because that's the only way they know how to get the things they want, and that makes them useful as carriers of the agendas of these implacable forces.
Yeah, and I think it's no mistake that when is it Ray and Annie, they go out to one of the brownfields. And it basically looks like a cemetery. I first thought of Arlington Cemetery. It's all these stakes with all these ribbons just lined up all over the place. I was like, this is laying it out right here. Because that's where they start talking about the heavy metal dumping and the pollution that Vinci generates. And there's no way out of that. Okay, so I need to warn you, I'm going to have to get off in about 5 minutes.
Feeling the same, like we've covered so much, and yeah. So, is there anything else that you want to bring up in these final moments?
We'll hang up, and there'll be 15 things I'll think to say.
Sure.
But I think we've said a lot about it. I think one of the good things about both seasons of this is that there's always more to come. Oh, well, one thing I didn't actually do any writing about, but I think it's really interesting. If you ever rewatch it. Look at the pattern of bruising on the girl playing guitar in the bar, because it changes throughout the show. She's the closest thing we have to a Greek chorus in there.
All right.
And T-Bone Burnett does the music, and he is somebody to be reckoned with. And I think her song choices are key.
Yeah, and I think the first song, isn't it, This Is My Least Favorite Life?
Yeah, this is not like, oh my God.
But that's the eternal return again. Huh?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Bird on the edge.
As you know, I called you back to do an extra section for our talk because of realizing right after it that I had not brought up what I felt was the main theme of True Detective, or at least of my experience of it, which is to do with what's kind of commonly known as mother bondage, what is more subtly referred to as immersion in the mother's psyche. Are you familiar with this notion at all?
Kind of. I guess probably more from some Freudian stuff, you know, some French psychological stuff. A bit, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's this idea of inescapability, right?
Well, it occurred to me that it's a weird thing, as I said to you, I think, in the email, that it struck me the fact that I'd forgotten to bring it up, and we just hadn't got there, that it relates to this idea of a secret that protects itself. And the whole notion, I'd say, the reality of the male psyche that isn't able to disenmesh or individuate from the mother's psyche is both a cliché, if you think of... I mean, the most famous cases would be the two films that Hitchcock did, his most famous films, really, Vertigo and then Psycho, and obviously Psycho, Norman Bates being the most obvious cultural artifact or narrative that speaks to this, the whole thing of a male child being possessed by the mother. So it's this cultural cliche that everybody's familiar with, but it also seems to be this thing that nobody's really aware of and nobody's talking about, because Norman Bates is an extreme case, and as I see it, it's something that's actually throughout Western society, this problem, if you like, or this condition that I've been exploring in the last few years, beginning actually when I met the woman who became my wife, and actually that was coincident with my mother's becoming ill and eventually dying. Those things progressed together, like me meeting my partner and marrying her and my mother becoming ill and dying, and it was very apparent to me the correlation between these two things, because I was, in order to be able to actually step into the role of a husband, I needed to disenmesh from my mother's psyche, and that had this very powerful effect on her, which was actually, in the end, was terminal. Not to say that it was a cause and effect thing, but that these two things were happening parallel. It's this very personal thing that I've uncovered, and as I say, my experience as True Detective was, by the end, was... It stirred something in me that I recognized to do with my own wounded masculinity. We were talking about Colin Farrell last time we spoke, and I loved the way that you described that. I was listening to it yesterday with my wife, of him being this, like carrying the pieces of himself around in a little basket. And that's essentially how I began to feel when I began to really recognize the extent of my... trauma and of my enmeshment in the mother's psyche, my being lost in the underworld of, and the Freudian thing is about the lost object, that the child that can't individuate from its mother, or that is separated from her in a way that is unnatural and harsh and traumatic, or that never connects to her properly, or all of these things, becomes fixated on the image of her body, on the idea and the memory of her body, and essentially can't move away from that image. And that seemed to be depicted in the end of True Detective with Frank's walk through the desert. That's the last thing he sees, is the image, not of his mother, but of the woman that, you know, has his mother's surrogate.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, you know, sort of in thinking about how to approach this. You know, I went back to our old friend Greek Tragedy, and, you know, what happens with women in these things, they're frequently the ones left they're the ones left alive, which we see in True Detective, because of somehow the loss of male authority. And there's this really strong, in True Detective, there's this really strong link between female generative power and male authority. And I think you can make the case that it goes beyond simply having children, like we talked last time. There's this real undercurrent, again, part of the underworld, this real undercurrent of the significance of the woman as a mother figure, or a mother associated with a woman, because we've got the two characters, we've got Annie and Tony Chisani's daughter, who are still carrying the burden of their mother's deaths. Tony Chisani's daughter, Tony Chisani's wife, ostensibly killed herself, though there may be some evidence that she had some help along the way from Dr. Pittler. But yeah, I mean, there's all these dead mothers hanging around, walking around in the background. And you're right, nobody, these guys can't, these characters, and yeah, I'll give Fitz a lot of credit, he treats everybody equally poorly, you know, with regard to this. Everybody is walking around looking at these shadows and trying to still engage with them and trying to reconcile all that stuff. And you can't really reconcile. I don't know if you could really reconcile when that other person is not there. I think you're limited, and I think you have to, you know, figure out what it is you're going to hold on to and what it is you're going to let go. And that's the thing that makes Annie a little more complex, because she thinks she's dealt with it, and she really hasn't. And, you know, she didn't have the protection she needed when she was a kid, and paid the price for that for the rest of her life. And all of these guys, you know, it's the damaged childhood creating damaged adults, and the absent mother, Frank's absent mother. You know, Jordan says to him, we both could have used better parents. So she's got something going on that we don't have to see, because we see enough. We see enough to know that it's real for her. And I think that's very deftly done.
Well, there's one thing that's kind of unclear around this whole thing for me so far, and this is that there's a very fundamental difference between a woman, a female child, remaining enmeshed with the mother and a male child. And obviously this has to do with the gender, and that, you know, a male child who is possessed by his mother, to put it in very simple terms, can't actually enter into his maleness, can't actually become masculine or upright. Whereas a female child who's possessed by the mother doesn't have that same. She will inherit the sort of matriarchal force of that, of the generative power of the female is still passed on, despite the fact that the female child can't individuate.
Right, and I think it's key to Pizzolatto that we know that Annie's mom is dead. And that there's this really cold line that comes from her dad in that first episode, when he basically says, well, you know, if she'd been a better actress, she might be alive today.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that, you know, that was really a really cold touch, and I thought it was well placed. But I think that's sort of the first signal that people are not going to be treated well in these roles. So she's dead, with Tony Chisani's wife is dead. There's some closure there. I don't know that we ever find out. Or did Frank tell us that his mom was dead and that's why he was living with his dad? I can't remember what the full part of that story was.
I don't remember any mention of Frank's mother. No.
Yeah, because he talks about his dad and living in the apartment and all that good stuff. We get a really long story about that. But we don't know if his mom's dead. We don't know if, you know, if Paul, we know Paul Woodrow's mother is alive. We see her.
Yeah.
She is in vivid color, but she is no kind of mother.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. So that's very overt.
Yeah, she is a non-mother. She is sort of, you know, the biological mother who was never an emotional mother. And you know, I don't think that Pizzolatto really makes the case people used to make, that gay men had damaged relationships with their mothers and that's why they were gay, and you know, their mothers had made them gay. I think he really avoids that. I think his Paul's mom was so damaged before he ever came around that I think that relationship was inevitable, and that how it played out was pretty much inevitable.
Well, he certainly doesn't make it he doesn't reduce it to some kind of very pat formula. But because I hadn't even thought about it, despite my own interpretation of the whole season, I hadn't thought about the relationship between Woodrow and his mother and how painful, I mean, how unpleasant that was to watch, and the way that she sexualizes him. And clearly, if she's doing it to him as an adult, she would have done that to him as a child. And that's very much part of this idea of emotional incest, and again, speaking from experience, is very key to this phenomenon in which the male child can't actually separate from the mother because the mother is emotionally invested in him and turns him into a husband surrogate and actually a poison container, a way to feel good about herself. That was an experience I had growing up. My mother was an alcoholic. She was estranged from my father by the time I was born, and she did find another man and go off with him, and she met him about around the time that I was two. So that indicates in those first couple of years she was estranged from my father and hadn't found a new lover, and I came along and I was very much that, you know, her emotional surrogate for a husband.
Well, we've got this whole spectrum, you know, of relationships, don't we? We've got kind of like what you're describing there. You've got the Paul and his mom. We've got this almost complete enmeshment, not without loss of identity. I mean, Paul, you know, this is that big fight we witnessed the last time we see her. That's probably not the first time they've had a fight like that. You get the feeling that this is a really stormy relationship. So in that sense, he's not subordinate in the relationship. And, you know, enmeshment doesn't automatically mean you're subordinate.
No, I wasn't at all with my mother. We were fighting all the time. You know?
So, you know, you've got this one. And then you come over here to the other end where we know nothing about Frank's. And we know even less about Jordan's. We get this one mention, this one sentence, you know, that is very oblique about her parents. So
what was the sentence again?
When she said we both could have used better parents.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's as much as we hear about her family of origin. And then you see on screen, you know, Annie and her dad did the Chisani, you know, made for TV disaster. You know, playing out every time you go into that house. All this different stuff. The kids who lost their parents. So you've got those shadows walking around. I mean, really, when you start talking about that degree of family, that's really sort of the central underworld. That's to me, would be the closest thing we come to completely blending this Greek idea of an underworld and the criminal idea of an underworld. It's all of these figures all together, you know, carrying the weight of history and walking around with these shadows that, essentially, I guess, they could only see themselves. Everybody's got a personal underworld.
Yeah, is there something, then, in the Greek mythology that, for you, corresponds with this idea of the kind of consuming mother psyche? Like, I mean, the Medusa was obvious in terms of the symbolism of the head with the snakes, but is there anything actually in the narrative there that you see as corresponding?
Medea kills her own children.
Okay, that's a big one.
Just because her husband annoys her one day. I mean, Medusa and Medea are the two big ones, I think.
What happens to the children that Medea kills, assuming that they don't just end? Do they go to the underworld?
I think they get a religious burial. But yeah, I mean, that's essentially. Yeah, you don't see their ghosts come back or anything like that. Like sometimes you do, you don't see anything like that. Not that I recall. Yeah, I mean, in Greek tragedy, all kinds of mothers are, you know, in all different kinds of places. I keep thinking about Orpheus and Eurydice and all of this. Tennessee Williams, and it's interesting because there's a Eurydice mother. And then there's the Eurydice who goes to the underworld, who Orpheus tries to rescue. Two different people, but Tennessee Williams said that he thought the dominant myth in Western literature, and a lot of Western literature anyway, was Orpheus and Eurydice. That there's a man out there trying to rescue a woman or trying to help a woman and can't ever do it right. And you see this all through Tennessee Williams' plays.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking, is this something going on here? you know, can is there a link here? Maybe is there some sort of beyond simple the simple love relationship of Orpheus and Eurydice? Is there something more? Some you know, a man trying to reach out and reclaim something? And I haven't had a chance to think a whole lot about that, but I think you might be able to make a case in a few instances anyway.
Well, of course. I mean, that's the classic myth. I mean, I even remember as a adolescent or pre-adolescent daydreaming, like many adolescents, I'm sure at school, about rescuing maidens, you know, rescuing beautiful girl in distress. And of course, that's the whole age of chivalry and the myths of the knights. It's all about that. So the basic idea is to rescue the feminine principle that somehow has been endangered by the dragon, by these destructive forces of the id. So that seems to be what that's about. But what's interesting in this context to me is that it seems that it's the flip side of a much less recognized dynamic and a much less prevalent myth or narrative, which is the reverse, which is, well, not exactly the reverse, but the male child that needs to be rescued by the father from the mother's psyche, that it seems that what the thing that is necessary for the male child to be able to individuate and separate from the mother's psyche and develop a sense of his own identity and his own autonomy is for the father to intervene. Like, this is a biological program, and it may even be that it's necessary that the man who intervenes for the male child is the biological father. I don't know, but that may be the case, and maybe there was something around this, because the whole plot of True Detective season 2 begins with Ray's attempt to connect to his father, to his son, and be present as his father, right? To be there, but also the question of whether he's actually the biological father.
That whole thing, what does it mean to be a father? Pizzolatto's clearly making the case that this guy's a dad because he wants to be a dad, not just because somebody told him he was a dad. He actually wants to be a dad. And the thing about male intervention is really interesting, because the one place where we see that quote-unquote successfully is Tony Chisani and his dad, the mayor. You know, this is the mayor intervened on Tony Chisani's behalf at one point. Somebody, I think it was one of the cops, maybe Ray Vaccaro, who said he pulled him over. He was so coked up that his face was almost like completely white and stuff like that.
That was Frank, wasn't it? Because it was Frank may have was been helping Frank. Out
yeah,
the
that
mayor.
Was Frank. Yeah. So this is really the only place where we see a father successfully intervening in the life of his child. I mean, you see, you know, Annie's dad admitted that they didn't know about the molestation and couldn't, you know, be there to step in right when it was happening. And you get the feeling that she never really wanted his help with anything. She didn't want his intervention. And maybe even if he had tried, she probably would have rejected it. But nowhere else, you know, we see Ray, and Ray really wants to, but he's got too many of his own battles to fight internally. He can't really, he doesn't have margin to take on someone else's battles, which is, I think, what you got to have. And, you know, he's made it clear he doesn't have it. He's got too many of his own. So whatever he tries is pretty much condemned to fail, because he's not going to have the right headspace, you know, to figure out what to do.
Well, it seems like it's too charged for him. Like, his desire to be a father for his son is actually what's driving him, as we see from the beginning, and it's also what drives him to commit these terrible acts. It's how we see just how messed up he is,
right?
And how not just he's not a good father, he's not a good human being. So that suggests that it's too important to him, right? Like, he's trying to give to his son what he didn't get, and we don't see much about his relationship with his father, but we see enough that it's not functional. I mean, they don't have a close relationship, and he followed his father's footsteps and became a cop, and so that's how he ended up, the kind of cop that he ended up. If that was following his father's example, then clearly, you know, there was something that wasn't working there in his relationship with his father. So Yeah, to some extent, I think we can deduce that Ray didn't get that intervention that he needed from his father, and so he would have, all of that stuff would have been stirred up by having his child. And of course, that would have happened after the rape, and God only knows, the kind of space that that hurtled him into,
Yeah.
before his son was even born. And
the rape is really sort of the turning point for him. When you get that flip back in time and he is walking into Frank Simeon's bar that first time, doesn't know Frank, doesn't know anything, you can see, and Colin Farrell did this really well, you can see he's visibly damaged from what happened to his wife.
Yeah.
It is visible that this is already one shadow that he's carrying around with himself. And compounding that on he thinks he's going to, as he says later, he's going to get closure if he kills this guy. He kills the guy, he gets away with it, doesn't help, doesn't change anything. So that's another shadow that he's having to carry on. So he's got too many burdens. Add that on top of, go ahead.
No, as I say, of course it does change something, but not in a good way, because it makes him,
right.
It turns him into Frank's henchman, essentially.
Yeah, and he's more and more brittle. I mean, this whole idea about, difficulty making you stronger really is not playing out well in these people's lives. I mean, they're not, for whatever reason, and I think it's more than just any single explanation you could offer, these guys can't really deal with life. They can't really deal with what's going on with them. All they can do is postpone the effects and bracket things off and put things... Again, put things into an underworld. Put them into a place where they could roam around and other people don't find out about it.
Well, it escalates, doesn't it? Because
mm-hmm.
it's occurring to me now that, like with the Greek myth of, is it Greek? Pluto, abducting Persephone.
Yeah, that's Roman. Pluto's Roman, Hades is Greek.
Hades,
but it's the same thing.
The same story, yeah. So that the forces of the unconscious that are coming and abducting the conscious thing. And so that the rape of Ray's wife is obviously overlaps with that, the whole rape of Persephone. I mean, the idea of rape as an archetypal thing. And what happens as a result of that is that Ray commits the murder to avenge her, and he becomes a hostage. He gets abducted into the underworld as a result of that.
Yeah, everybody is Odysseus. Odysseus has to go into the underworld and does so differently from Aeneas, who goes into the underworld specifically to become the founder, of an empire. But, everybody's got to go down and see and deal with what they learned there. And these guys don't have the skills to do that.
Well, sorry to keep jumping in. All these things occurring to me now, because it's
okay.
The Orpheus and Eurydice thing you were talking about earlier. That is maybe what's going on with Ray then, because his wife is raped, so she's abducted into the underworld. He ends up going into the underworld as a result of that. So it's as if he's actually trying to rescue her, to undo the past, essentially, to make it right. Of course, he fails. He ends up becoming a man that she can't even love and she rejects. But by the end of the season, he's, of course, still in the underworld, but he has, in some sense, he's found his Eurydice, which is Bezerides, and he has rescued her.
Station pulls away from the train. The blue pulls away from the sky. The whisper of two broken wings. Maybe they're yours, maybe they're mine. This is my least favorite life, the one where I'm out of my mind, the one where you're just out of reach, the one where I stand and you fly. I'm wandering in the shade.
By sending her into another underworld, which is really, again, but he does. I mean, it's really sort of interesting. Nobody can escape. There is no escape.
Well, I wonder. I mean, I know this. I think we talked about this last time, and I think it's definitely a valid interpretation. But at the same time, I didn't find the end of the show to be completely pessimistic or completely closed, you know, like there did seem to be an opening there for Bezerides and for the son, even though that son was going to grow up without a father. It seemed like there'd be an awareness of that, and that to me is the real damage and the real harm. Isn't so much that the father has been ousted from the whole dynamic of a male child, you know, growing up, and but that he's become seen as irrelevant, that there's actually no awareness of how essential the role of the father is to intervene in that way. So I think that Bezerides by then would have reached that awareness, and that at least would allow for some healing, you know, generationally. I'm just kind of making
this
up.
And it's interesting,
but,
the first male that little child is going to know is probably going to be Nails, who is this unbelievably loyal person.
Right.
As you go through, you wonder about everybody at some point. You know, is it Jordan? Is it whoever? And you wonder about Nails briefly, but by the end, nope, he is completely faithful, going to do the job, going to see it through. This is the figure that child is going to see most intimately, you know, as a male figure, and that those values, Nails' values of loyalty, you know, and stoicism and all that stuff, because you can't be what you were to Frank Simeon without having a certain value set. Those are what's going to be exhibited, at least in front of that kid, if not actually transmitted. So is that a bad thing? I don't know. I think that may be a pretty good thing. It's kind of like a reparenting in some ways. You know, this kid is going down a different path. He's got the mom who's got her history, but she has experienced some degree of healing with it. And then you've got this one male figure, and we don't know if others may come into the picture, but here's this guy who's got really strong values. So maybe this is a new start.
Yeah. Yeah, and Nail's character is fascinating, because I don't know if he even has a single line until the last episode. If he does, I don't even remember. So he's just this kind of silent presence that for a long time I just kept looking at him thinking, who is that guy? Is he even a human being? You know, he's just so kind of primordial presence.
And which is really, I mean, I think that's super cool because the actor could do that with this character who has no lines, who only stands there and holds a facial expression. I mean, that's way more difficult than people realize, I think. And, you know, Pizzolatto crafted this. You know, this stuff doesn't happen at random. Hmm. This was a set of choices on Pizzolatto's part. Here it is, and it's there for us to look at. So
yeah. Well, he's Italian, right, Pizzolatto?
Yeah.
So he's
name like that, you're not going to be Irish,
right? Yeah. And so he's almost certainly Catholic background. And the ending is them disappearing into a Virgin Mary crowd. So that's the mother's psyche, and of course the only ostensible potential father figure, this pure warrior presence, really. Nails would be a protector, but that's about it. Can't imagine him giving much by way of emotional support. His name is Nails.
Yeah, hard as nails, yeah. Yeah, he's going to be a difficult man.
Right, but I mean the Christ thing. I was making the Christ correlation.
Yeah, the crucifixion. The whole thing with the Virgin Mary parade at the end celebration, whatever that was, when they first cut to that statue of the Virgin Mary, the first thing I thought of was episode one, when they get into Casper's house and they're going down into his office, and there's the skeleton dressed in the exact same headdress, holding a baby, I think. So you get this, it's a black skeleton in front of Parker, but I could be wrong about that. But yeah, you get the bookends of this image in episode one and episode eight.
So I remember the skeleton, but to me it seemed more like some sort of Egyptian pharaoh. I don't know why exactly, but how are you?
I'll have to go look at it again, but I want to say it has the veil, that headdress thing that they you can tell I'm not Catholic. That headdress thing that they put on the Virgin Mary and a lot of the iconography.
You're probably right, because I don't know where it was, but the name of Santa Muerte came up when I was reading about True Detective recently, and so that's a female saint who corresponds with death. No,
well, that might have been her then.
Yeah.
That might have been her in Casper's office at home.
So I was listening to the first part of that talk yesterday with my wife, and she made, I thought, a very, really interesting comment, which was that the season one was about the organized sexual abuse of children.
Yeah.
Season two seemed to be about that to begin with, but by the end it's about the characters, and that these characters are the children who have been abused, grown up into adults, and what becomes of the victims of that kind of systemized abuse.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. Because the children in season one were murdered, so they were never, ever given a chance at adulthood.
Right.
Mm. But yeah, I would totally agree with it.
Yeah, I wonder how aware Pizzolatto was of that, because it certainly hadn't occurred to me, and it does make a thematic link between the two seasons in terms of he's exploring. To me, that's the core corruption, the core conspiracy is what's happening to children. And the whole of society, I mean, Lloyd DeMouse writes about this, that you can't understand history, society, anything, politics, without looking at what's happening to the children, because the children grow up to be the adults that implement the policies that create society. So really the only way to understand society or anything is to see how children are developing, you know, within that system. And so that is what I'm getting from True Detective, but I doubt if many people are, and it's even debatable how conscious Pizzolatto was of that kind of thread running through it. I suspect that he was, that he is. But
one of the things I kind of miss about this season was, remember last season, you got the little vignettes, the interview snippets of him after the episode, talking about elements in that episode. And, you know, here's why we made this decision. And thematically, here's what this is and all that.
Oh, really?
And I really was hoping that was going to happen this time. And I didn't get it. And I really was kind of disappointed because of
that. I must have missed that. I mean, in the downloads that we watched, we didn't get that. Maybe they ended too quickly.
But yeah, if you get a chance, those are worth seeing. It's interesting. Interesting to get his take on all those episodes.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, so, because, I mean, since I started to uncover these possible meanings, of course, that was one of the questions, you know, how consciously placed were they, and how accurate is my seeing? They don't have to be consciously put there to be there, of course, because the unconscious bleeds through any real work of art, and that's really what's informing it. But still, it's nice to know that the sum of it's at least conscious. And so there's a few things I found. Some of them I've mentioned already, but I'll mention briefly before we round up a couple of others to see what you think. One is the opening image, which is Colin Farrell's face emerging from what looks like, or going into what looks like, a woman's thighs. So.
Are you talking about the opening credits?
Yeah, the opening credit
image. Oh, yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, I could see. I sat and watched all the opening credits every time because I'm a dork. But yeah, right. I could totally see that. Yeah, you get the sexual image right from the start, so we know this is going to be a huge issue in this. Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, if you didn't think it right away, maybe it's not that obvious, but to me it looks like he's going down on somebody. That's
well,
what it looks like.
Well, like you said, just because I didn't see it doesn't mean that it's not there.
Right.
Yeah, I think you could make a case for that. That would be something interesting to get Pizzolatto to clarify. Yeah.
That would be interesting to know in general, because the feeling I got watching this season was that he was the controlling intelligence. There were all these different directors, but apart from that slump with 5 and 6, which seem to relate to the script and not just the direction, there was a consistent tone throughout, and so it seemed as though there was a single intelligence there that was presiding over it and making sure that the desired meanings were being communicated.
Yeah. And, you know, season 1, I scoured the credits, the opening credits, you know, for clues after the first episode or so. I mean, and there were no clues to be found. So, which was mildly disappointing.
Yeah, the other images that stand out in this regard is one that the female head looks like Jordan, that with some of the skull showing. So it's like a female death's head. There's that one.
Yeah.
And then there's an image of Ray emerging from what looks like a swimming pool. So it's just, he's submerged in water anyway, up to his nose. And then the weird artifact in Casper's house, it's actually quite a well-known sculpture, the white water.
Yeah, the bowl with the woman in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's paralleled later with his daughter. You remember the first time the detectives go over to maybe the second trip over to the house? The daughter is in the swimming pool, and she's doing the same thing. She doesn't have a top on, but she's got a bikini bottom on.
Oh.
And she's floating on her back, and she looks over. So that image, at least, is duplicated. I don't know that piece of art is clearly not going to be his daughter. But, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff with water and renewal and, you know, the unconscious and all. That's way too deep to get into. but yeah. I thought that was a super interesting artwork. All the art on the walls. I mean, this is the replication in some ways of the Roman murals with all the sex going on. I mean, that's what we've got here. You know, we've got these big pictures, great too. We've got these big pictures of people having sex on the wall. So it's more than just the whole Casper is sex addict thing happening.
Yeah. All right. Well, as you say, this is way too deep to get into unless we begin a whole new exploration, but I'm up for doing that some other time. It occurred to me just this morning that your name, Heather Poirier, is very close to the famous detective Hercule Poirier.
Yeah, Yeah, you can blame my husband's sneaky French Canadian grandfather for that.
So it's entirely coincidental,
It is
in quotes.
entirely coincidental, yes.
That's great.
Too bad, huh? Too bad.
No, that's even better. That means that those deeper forces are at work. Doesn't
I hope that's as deep as they go. I've got enough problems without deeper forces taking an interest in me all of a sudden.
Oh, but they do, of course. They take an interest in all of this. No, I would say it means that you've been selected from a very long time ago to be this artist investigator detective. That would be my simple interpretation of
Well, that's not so bad. That
that.
wouldn't
Yeah,
be so bad.
that's what I mean. It's not so bad. You have been listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between number 27. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to the site, that's Auticulture, auticulture.com/liminalist, and click on donate in the right hand margin. Heather Poirier's blog is Notes on H.P. Lovecraft at blogspot.com. Heather will be appearing at the Necronomicon Providence at the Lovecraft Arts and Sciences on Rhode Island on August the 21st at 10:30. You can find more details at her blog. Lastly, I would like to thank Nick Pizzolatto and the makers of True Detective Season 2, everybody involved, for the fantastic work they did, without which, of course, this podcast and this particular episode, I mean, would not exist. And I hope that we've done something like justice to the work that everybody put into it. And last of all, I would like to dedicate these last two podcasts to my late brother, Sebastian, the dandy of the underworld.
Some say love, it is a river, and that it drowns the tender reed. And some say love, it's like a razor, and that it leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love, it is a hunger, an endless aching need. I say love, it is a flower, and you, its only seed. Learns to dance. It's the dream, afraid of waking, that never takes the chance. It's the one who won't be taken, seem to give, and the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. When the night has been too lonely, the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose.